When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Across the Sky is proudly sponsored by Weather Call Services. Don't be caught off guard in severe weather. Choose Weather Call.
Well, spring is here, and we are talking about pollen and all that good stuff on this week's Across the Sky podcast. I'm meteorologist Joe Martucci. Tell me, Across the Sky podcast team, what are your seasonal allergies like, if at all, during the spring?
They really don't bother me that much. Now, granted, I'm in Chicago now. And I will say that the tree pollen is not as bad here as other places I've lived, like Richmond, Virginia, Sean. When I lived there, boy, I could not believe the amount of pollen. There's also a lot of pollen when I lived in Starkville, Mississippi, going to Mississippi State for a couple of years. Even in Texas, in San Antonio, the oak trees put out a nasty brown pollen. And I felt like I saw, so everywhere I've lived, I feel like I've seen more pollen. In Chicago, not as bad. But even when I was living in places where there's more pollen, I would say, you know, I got a little bit of an itchy nose, especially when those levels got real high, but I'm not allergic to any specific pollens, and that really makes an impact. So it's just kind of, more than anything, it's just the mess that the pollen makes. That's what has been a bigger issue for me. All the times I have to wash my car in these places with a lot of pollen. So annoying, but it doesn't really affect my health too much.
Yeah, I never, that's not true. I can't say I never. I have been affected by it, but I almost feel like I form immunity to it. Now, I'll tell you, Tulsa, you know, being just kind of in the heart of the country here, there's a lot of stuff that flies around. And there's a lot of growth. And it bothered me when I first moved here, but now I've seemed to just kind of, like I said, become immune. But I do know a lot of people that suffer from it, and it sounds miserable. So my heart goes out to them.
Isn't so much trees for me. I don't know if growing up here helped in Richmond, but for me, it's the grass pollen. And I really didn't even have issues with that until I was older, into my early 20s. But we'll get into this spell in late May and early June, where I will have just a couple of weeks where it's pretty bad. I'm sneezing a lot just because the grass is going through its pollination the most. So I do reasonably well through the, you know, the tree season, if you will, but the grass is what gets me the worst.
I used to be like more allergic to seasonal allergies when I was a kid. And then, I don't know, like once I got, probably like, I don't know, 23 or 24 years old, like I stopped just having that much of an issue. Still, I get a little bit, you know, during like the peak of it, but it's not like it used to be where I would literally remember sitting in my parents' basement with a throbbing headache above my right eyebrow for 5 hours in a row. So I've come a long way, so I'll take it. And it's very fitting we're talking about allergies because we have Teresa Crimmin. She's the director of the USA National Phenology Network. She's also with the University of Arizona. She is back again. If you are a loyal listener of the Across the Sky podcast, you have heard Teresa. She is actually our most frequent guest with today's episode. But she's going to talk to us about the status of spring, where we are at so far, who is ahead of schedule, who's behind schedule, and we talk a lot about allergies too. So with that, we're going to turn it over to our interview with Teresa Crimmin. And we welcome back on Teresa Crimmin, director of the USA National Phenology Network. Teresa, you are now our most popular guest on the Across the Sky podcast. You are our most frequent guest. How's it feel?
I guess it means I haven't done too terribly the last previous couple of rounds. I'm very honored. Thank you.
Yeah, no, you're definitely doing something right. We always enjoy speaking with you about phenology, and especially as we're getting into spring. You know, I think what your website usanpn.org is most popular for is, you know, comparing when these first leafing or blooms happen and comparing it to, you know, average here. And, you know, looking at the map here, it's March 28th when we're recording this, and You know, it looks like for the southern tier of the country, it was slightly early. But once you start getting into like Kansas City, Missouri, into Iowa and Illinois, we see it being the spring being very early in regards to average here. So, you know, let's start with that. You know, what's going on over there in the parts of the Midwest? And then I also see, too, as you get down towards southern Texas, it was actually on the later end with this spring leaf index return interval.
Well, usually we have a cold, dark, long winter across most, if not all, of the country. And everybody's waiting so anxiously to see those first signs of spring. The crocuses popping up through the snow, or the tiny little leaflets that's starting to sneak out of the tree branches. So something that can give us some indication that warmer, brighter days are on the way. And so we have a couple of models that we use to make forecasts about when that activity is likely to occur. And so we have a couple of different products. The first basically it reflects the conditions that are associated with the very beginning of biological activity in the spring. And then we have another product that encapsulates conditions indicative of more like kind of once spring has gotten going. It's typically reached about a month or so after that initial map. So that initial map product, that map that indicates when is spring biological activity just getting started, we have reached those conditions, like you said, across much of the country now. We're creeping up into the southern reaches of Wisconsin and Michigan, and going across the east, we're now starting to see that those conditions pop in southern New York and into Massachusetts, and then also, of course, Arizona, California, and some of the Pacific Northwest. In much of the country, those conditions were reached earlier than average. Like you said, not in the southern tiers of southern tier of states, not so much. We really weren't early in terms of when we started to experience the start of activity in Texas, Louisiana, Florida. But yes, in the Midwest, you know, Nebraska, Iowa, Illinois, Ohio, it definitely was earlier than when we usually see these conditions reached in recent decades. However, in a lot of those cases, it wasn't so early that it isn't something that we haven't seen recently. Basically, what it means is, yes, we've reached those conditions maybe 2 or 3 weeks earlier than on average. But we actually see that kind of activity happen at that frequency pretty frequently, once every 5 years or so. It really is only in, say, the middle of Iowa, parts of Nebraska, northern Ohio, where it was crazy early, where it really was. It really did stand out as something kind of special. And I think that that is the result of the very warm winter and spring that we had in so much of the northern part of the country, combined with sustained warmth. But now it's actually slowed back down, because you all can speak to this more knowledgeably than I have, than I can, but it is cold right now. It's basically, you know, we're in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s in much of the country. And those kinds of temperatures actually don't prompt plants to start, you know, really putting on leaves and opening their flowers. When it's chillier like that, they kind of hang tight. They pause. And so it's really the warm days, and especially anomalously warm days, that prompt that activity. And so it's funny how it's playing out this spring, where it's early, but it's not something that's really going to go down in the history books, I would say.
Let's talk about the warmth. And I've heard of something called chilling hours. Is there some way, and I'm guessing this goes into how you do the formulas that go to the maps. Can you speak to that point about how different species, and I know there's all kinds of species, but how different species kind of add up how long they've been cool or cold, and then use that as a cue as to when they should start coming out for the spring?
Sure. Yes. So the products that I just was describing and the patterns, you know, that we're kind of trying to track across the country right now basically are an encapsulation of warmth. What prompts plants and animals in the spring to come out of their hibernation or their dormancy by and large, in temperate environments, which is most of our country, is temperature in the spring. It's exposure to warmth. However, day length can play a role for some species. And you're right, exposure to chill can play an important role for a number of species as well. And that's especially true in some of our fruit crops, fruit trees, things like cherries and related species, where they actually need to be exposed to a particular amount of cold temperatures or chill over the winter in order to actually then start paying attention to the warmth that they get exposed to subsequently to then prepare themselves to put on their leaves and open their flowers. What researchers have observed in some species and in recent years where we've had really warm winters is that if they are not exposed to the necessary amount of chill, they get confused. And actually, in some cases, we see a delay in activity in those species. Even though they're getting exposed to plenty of warmth, they're not sure. They're thinking, hey, but I can't tell if it's safe for me to start putting on my leaves and flowers because I can't tell what time of year it is because we didn't seem to have winter. And so in some cherries in particular, which are some of the ones that we know the most about, if those trees aren't being exposed to the sufficient chill, they either flower later, they flower less, they produce less fruit. And so it stands to create havoc, honestly.
Yeah, and Teresa, I kind of want to focus back in on that because it was a very mild winter in the Midwest. I mean, we saw some incredibly warm temperatures, especially in the far northern Midwest, places like North Dakota, Minnesota. It was crazy how far above normal temperatures were. And so a lot of folks were like, well, winter's over. But then early March came around and we just saw some epic snow in North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Minnesota. And so I'm thinking that, you know, you have all these plants that are like, okay, and animals that are coming out. It's like, okay, spring, but boy, we just got a shot of cold air and snow and wintry conditions again. And, you know, we're seeing this more often where it seems like the thing is, you know, winter does linger. We talked about it in our top 10 things to know about spring podcast, how the last freeze in a lot of places isn't until late March, April, or even into early May. So you're not in the clear yet. But what we're seeing in winter are these warm spells happening earlier and these record warm temperatures. And so plants, animals think spring has begun, but we still get these cold shots of air in winter. So I'm wondering what research has been done and how the plants and animals are responding to these early start to spring, but yet still getting these tastes of winter.
Yeah, so it stands to play out in all different ways. The species that don't necessarily need that exposure to chill, they just respond to warmth. If they experience exposure to warmth earlier than they are used to, basically that triggers them to leaf out or flower early. And then you are absolutely right. If they are then hit with subsequent sub-freezing temperatures, that can be really problematic. It can be, you know, I don't know, it can set them back a bit if they've put on their leaves and leaves get hit by frost, then the plants need to invest energy to produce those leaves again. It can be really devastating, though, if it's the situation where plants are putting on opening up sensitive flower tissues. Things again and again. It especially intersects if those flower tissues are crop species. It's things like cherries, peaches, and other related trees that put on their flowers actually before they leaf out, and as soon as they expose those flowers, they are very frost sensitive. And if they get exposed to those cold temperatures can kill those fruit flowers. And that's a problem because the trees won't put on another round of flowers. And if you don't have flowers, you don't have fruit. And so if those particular flowers, and that this extends to apples as well, are hit by frost, then you can have major crop losses. And in some recent springs, we have experienced that because of these sequence of events. An upside that we might be seeing in that part of the country, though, is that there may be better insect control at this point. I had just a few weeks ago been reading some blog posts by extension folks, I think in Minnesota, who had been saying, you know, we've had such a really warm winter, it's not going to knock back the various agricultural pests like we kind of need them to. Those sub-freezing temperatures are really important for reducing the populations of the kinds of pests that can really be problematic for particular crops. And up until a few weeks ago, those temperatures just hadn't hit that area. However, if those, you know, the Dakotas and Minnesota and Wisconsin, where we've got a lot of ag land, are finally getting some cold, that may help actually have that positive control on those bugs.
Awesome. Well, good stuff so far, Teresa. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back on the other side with the Across the Sky podcast.
Hey, everyone. Across the Sky is proudly sponsored by Weather Call Services. Don't be caught off guard by severe weather. Choose Weather Call. Get precise, location-specific alerts via phone, text, or email. With over a decade of experience, Weather Call delivers pinpoint accuracy for your exact address, ensuring no surprises. Take charge and stay prepared when ominous skies loom. Explore the Weather Call difference today. Visit weathercallservices.com/Lee Enterprises and safeguard yourself, your business, or any school that matters to you. You can also find that link in our Across the Sky show notes, weathercallservices.com/Lee Enterprises.
And we are back with Teresa Crimmins here talking all things spring and what will be next, allergies. We have Kirsten wanting to ask you a question about the allergy season that is.
Yeah, you know, it's always, I think, a hot topic on a lot of people's minds. And I guess my question for you, Teresa, is do you notice any difference really with allergens and the type of winter that we had? So given that we just came off a really mild winter, does that spark a more intense allergy season for those that suffer from trees, et cetera, grasses? Or, you know, is it more of a cold? I mean, is there a correlation with that?
Sure. Yeah. So anytime that we have warm winters and springs, and as a consequence, plants initiate their leaf out and flowering activity earlier, we subsequently see an earlier start to the allergy season. And over the last several decades, pretty much across the country, we have seen a significant lengthening of the allergy season. A recent study showed that on average, just since 1990, the allergy season is about 3 weeks longer than it used to be. And unfortunately, it's about trees and other allergenic plants that produce pollen that are problematic for us are pumping out about 20% more pollen than they did in previous decades. And that is pretty much the consequence of overall warming temperatures, which allow for this longer growing season, as well as the increased concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which in very simplistic terms act as fertilizer for the plants and help them to basically grow larger and pump out more pollen. So, you know, this year again, we are seeing an earlier start to things across much of the U.S., and so the anecdotal reports that I have seen and heard about have followed suit. Basically, folks are, yep, experiencing things earlier and to greater extent. And it's just, there's unfortunately no good news in here. You know, the projections going forward are the growing season is going to continue to get longer and the plants will continue to pump out more pollen. And it even... worst little piece of the story is that research has even indicated that some of the plants are, and ragweed in particular, which is one that so many people are sensitive to, is actually now starting to generate pollen that is more allergenic for us. It's not, and it's spreading in its distribution. It's creeping northward too. So I wish I had something better to say, but it's on that topic, it's all gloom and doom.
Yeah, that's not what we want to hear. But what strikes me as most interesting, because I've heard people, you know, express like, oh, what's the big deal? Okay, well, allergy season's starting earlier, but then it ends earlier, right? But what's interesting to me is you mentioned that the entire season is getting longer. So it's not an issue of like, well, it just starts earlier. We're shifting the time here. It starts earlier,
right,
but then it'll end earlier. So we're talking about the end staying the same. So overall, the season is getting longer. And so it's interesting that you mentioned because of the increased carbon dioxide-ish levels, we're actually just seeing the trees produce more pollen. So even in the peak of the season, there's just more pollen. So it's not just a shift in the timing here that we're talking about.
Right. And you know, there's a couple of different allergy seasons. Right now, it is the tree pollen that is the that what we're seeing is that is responsible for our symptoms. And then as we move into summer, we shift more into the grass and other weeds like the ragweed. And then later on, then you get to the mold and other spore things. And so, yeah, it's that whole season, really, that the period during which plants are actively growing and producing flowers and the subsequent pollen that is longer. Yes, it is longer. And I just want to point something out, because this is such a common misunderstanding. It's not all the pollen from all the plants that is a problem. It's only the wind pollinated plants that we really need to worry about. And those are the ones that, honestly, you probably don't even notice that they're generating pollen, other than, say, pines, pine trees and other conifers. It's obvious, you know, you bump into them and then a huge cloud of yellow comes billowing out. That's bad. And that is pollen that is problematic. But your flowering cherries or your other gorgeous, down here we have Palaverde trees that at right around now start, they're just loaded with yellow flowers. They're so beautiful. And if trees and plants are putting effort into making beautiful flowers and ones that are showy and smell good, it's because they're trying to attract pollinators. They're trying to bring in bees and butterflies and other insects that do the work for them of gathering up that pollen, either on purpose or accidentally, and moving it to other plants to pollinate them. If they put forth that effort, then they're relying on pollinators to do that service for them. Wind pollinated plants are relying on wind currents to move their pollen for them. So they don't bother making pretty flowers, and instead they put all their energy into producing a whole bunch of abundant pollen that then, you know, is very small and lightweight and will fly on wind currents, and we can inhale it. So those are the bad guys. Don't diss the pretty trees and flowers.
Do we have anything new or any research that is specific to the grass pollens?
I'm lightly trying to track, you know, stuff in the allergy journals, and I'm fairly connected now with folks tracking this kind of stuff. And it's always the tree stuff. Part of it is the best data that we have on pollen is the monitoring stations that are not private; they're privately run, right. And those data are not broken out for grasses. They are broken out by taxonomic group for trees. So we know it's maple's pollen season, it's oak pollen season, it's, you know, alders are really bad right now, junipers are bad. But for grasses, they just lump everything in Poaceae, which is the grass family. It'll just say Poaceae. And so I feel like maybe that's a reason they get less attention, less research.
Dovetail back to the data that you said before. I mean, getting hardcore data over one site, a long time series of pollen data, is hard. And I don't think people really understand that we have good data for things like wind and temperature, but good data over a long period at a particular site on pollen is tough, right?
Yes. So here in this country, we don't have a formal monitoring program that generates publicly available data on pollen. The best data that we have are collected through samplers, passive samplers that are mounted on the rooftops of some hospitals or private allergy facilities. And they're privately run. And what it requires is that they have this sampler up on the rooftop, say. Somebody has to go up there and collect the sample periodically, ideally daily, and then bring it down and get the pollen onto a microscope slide, and some trained individual has to actually look through a microscope to identify those different pollen grains. They look different when they are, you know, maple versus oak versus grass, but you still need to be trained to know what's what, and they have protocols for how to identify them and then how to count them. And so that generates a information on not only what pollen is in the air at that location on that date, but how much. But those data, because that is very labor intensive, by and large are maintained privately. And so to access them, researchers are able to access them to try to better understand dynamics and changes and the kind of stuff that we talked about. But it actually, maybe surprisingly, isn't the information that the pollen maps and forecasts that we see online, say when we see our TV weather broadcast, are based on. Those are based on, as I understand, typically derivative information, things like the sale of allergy medications and that kind of information.
And Teresa, as we see temperatures continue to rise across the country with climate change, are we starting to see new species of plants and animals showing up in places where they haven't previously, perhaps, you know, species that like warmer weather showing up in locations where they previously weren't? And on the flip side, those tree and animal species, plant and animal species, that like the colder weather, are they starting to disappear from some locations? Are there starting to be signs that we could see some species actually go extinct, maybe not, or maybe at least changing where they live, shifting farther north? Are we seeing that in the research?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Yes. Changes, rapid changes in the conditions that are appropriate for the persistence of particular species is a pretty big thing. Species can adapt in the immediate by exhibiting what's called plasticity, meaning, you know, like shifting the timing of when they are, say, flowering or fruiting or something. And then they can also adapt over the long term through genetic selection, meaning producing offspring that are better suited for novel conditions. The trouble that we're running into here, though, is conditions are changing fast enough, and many species reproduce slowly. It's taking the generation time to produce offspring isn't keeping pace with how quickly those conditions are changing, and so plants in particular struggle with this, and especially long-limbed species. Because they can't just pick up and move. You know, we are definitely seeing the situation where animal species are moving, say, northward, moving their ranges northward or up slope to higher elevations. In some cases, managers are actually considering taking explicit action termed assisted migration to try to help species track those new conditions as they shift northward in the northern hemisphere and up slope. So that they can persist.
You know, Teresa, I want to go back to the forecast, the pollen forecast question, because this is just something I've noticed. I feel like these websites are showing all different pollen forecasts for the same day. I go on one website, it says this. I go on one website, it says this, all for the same area. So to the best of your knowledge, like how, like, can we go a little more in depth on how these forecasts are made? And is there somewhere that you trust for the best place to get pollen forecast for, or whether it's a region or a zip code?
What you're saying is true. Many of them do disagree in their prediction. And I think that that's for a number of reasons. One being, again, the information that they're based on maybe it's kind of circular or an indirect measure of what's actually happening on the ground on individual plants. And as well, they're interpolated heavily. You know, if you only have information from a few discrete locations, but you want to generate a map that looks like it provides information across a continuous geographic area, then you have to, you know, kind of make up data that goes in between. And there are algorithms, mathematical models that can be implemented to do that. But sometimes they can make it look like we have more insight than we actually do. I'm working closely with a number of researchers who are actively trying to come up with better approaches for making pollen forecasts, because we are rather limited in this part of the country. And some of the techniques that they're experimenting with are both using satellite-derived information, so remote sensing techniques. Turns out that trees actually look a little bit different when they are flowering and releasing pollen. And we can especially see this in some of the conifers, like junipers and other cedars in the south. They get more yellow when they have a lot of pollen that's being released. And so that's helpful. And then also the ground-based reports that folks make through the Nature's Notebook program that we run, which is a program that anybody can participate in for tracking what plants and animals are doing over the course of the season in their yards. That information is really helpful too as ground validation that what we are predicting should be happening at a location is actually happening, and can help validate that imagery that's being collected by, say, drones or satellites in the sky.
And Teresa, is there anything that we haven't covered yet that you would like to point out to us? It's been a year since you've been on the podcast, so I imagine there's been a lot going on at the National Phenology Network. So is there something that we haven't discussed yet that stands out in your mind as something that you would like to bring up?
Well, you did give me the perfect segue already to kind of hint at Nature's Notebook. But again, that is our program where we invite everybody, anybody, to take a moment out of your day or even just your week and pay attention to maybe just one or two individual plants in your yard, or maybe some animals that you really like to track, and tell us formally what they are doing. I have a desert willow tree in my backyard that I love to watch, and I am right now with bated breath anticipating the day where it starts pushing out its purple blossoms, because it is so gorgeous. It will be loaded with these magenta trumpet-shaped flowers all through the summer, even when it's really, really hot. And I love this tree so much. It just rains those blossoms all season long, but I can't wait to figure out to see when that's going to start. And so I track that, and I track it formally through this program. And what's cool is I can go back. My husband and I are always saying to each other, should that be happening by now? Is this early this year? What happened last year? And I can go back in through our visualization tool and look at the reports that I have logged. And it settles a lot of arguments, actually, between us, which is nice. But I will say, this generates really important data that can be used in things like validating those pollen forecasts and improving those pollen forecasts. And it's just really good for my soul. I really benefit from that repeated activity, that regular activity of, hey, I got to just go step outside, walk around the backyard, make a few marks on a data sheet or using my phone app to record what I see. And I always am grateful that I took the moment that I did to do that, because I see such fun stuff and it's just good for my soul.
Nature's Notebook, doing it all, even a marriage mediator. Go figure. All right. Well, Teresa, we really appreciate the time. Tell us where we could follow you and the work that you're doing.
The website is usanpn.org. And I myself am on Blue Sky. I believe it's at Teresa Crimmins, and also on LinkedIn. Thank you.
Perfect. Great. Well, Teresa, thanks so much. We always appreciate you coming on, and thanks for being our most frequent guest on the Across the Sky podcast. We are going to take another break. We'll be back at the end for a few closing thoughts, and we'll wrap it on up from there.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Thanks again to Teresa for coming on and sharing all that good and maybe not so good stuff about allergies and where we are at the status of spring here. Her website's really great. It's very easy to navigate. You can see where you are in relative to history in terms of spring coming a little bit earlier or later than usual. So always a pleasure to have her on, and I'm sure we'll have her back on the podcast at some point soon. All right, so we're going to talk about Across My Sky is Across My Sky time. Sean, I'll kick it off with you since you're at the top left corner of my Zoom right now. What do we got going on in the Southeast?
So we got a lot of Easter stuff coming up this weekend. We've got parades. We got a NASCAR race. We've got a big thing at Maymont Park, the big park here in Richmond. I'm excited because opening day is coming up, and my Washington Nationals, God love them. We'll see how it goes when they open with Cincinnati a little before. We're recording this before the game. So these are the things I've got going. There's some other things that the wife and I are going to work at this weekend, because we've got some yard work to do, which is very appropriate after we've talked about all this pollen stuff. So there's yard work. There's all kinds of these little things going on.
Matt, I'll toss it over to you.
Yeah, for Across My Sky, I'm going to leave the Midwest and talk about where I just was in the Bahamas on a cruise. My first cruise, and what I realized is that of all the trips you can go on and all the vacations you can go on, I think weather might have the biggest impact on a cruise, because there were two ways that it impacted my trip. We were supposed to go to Nassau one day, but it was so stormy and wet and windy that my ship could not dock in the port in Nassau. So I did not get to spend a day in Nassau. And unlike a flight where your flight might be delayed or rescheduled for the next day, but you'll eventually reach your destination, that's not what happens on a cruise. You book that four-night cruise and that's all you're getting. So if you miss your port, you are not going to that port. So I missed an extra day on an island in the Bahamas that I was planning on because of the weather. I can't escape the weather. And then on the last night of the cruise, we actually had pretty smooth sailing, but the winds really picked up the last night. And while I was surprised how little I felt the ship moving most of the cruise, the last night, because of the wind, boy, was the ship rocking. And it was noticeable to the point where, you know, things weren't falling down and I wasn't falling down, but if you weren't careful walking, you could lose your balance. So it was very noticeable. And again, all because of the weather. And I started to feel those, that feeling of seasickness a little bit. It didn't get bad, but I was starting to feel it. And so I wasn't having as much fun on the last night because of the weather. So I had a great time still, love cruising, but I will say to people who've never been on a cruise and are thinking about booking a cruise, you just really have to keep your fingers crossed that you get nice weather for your cruise. Because if it's not nice weather, if you don't have quiet weather, the cruise is not going to be quite as fun.
And you know, at some point, we are going to talk about cruise ships and meteorologists who work for cruise ship companies. Sean and I, we were at the AMS conference in Baltimore. We had some time with Craig Seltzer. Am I saying his name right, Sean?
Setzer, I believe.
Setzer. Craig Setzer from Royal Caribbean. And he's a meteorologist for them down in Miami. We're going to get him on one of these episodes. Kirsten, I'll go over to you, and then I'll wrap it up.
You know, back to what Sean was talking about with Easter, I'll tell you what's happening here is that the growth, like the grass and just all the things, the weeds, they have gone crazy over the past couple of weeks. And the Easter Bunny is coming on Sunday.
That's
so
true.
So I told my husband, you better get out there and mow the lawn for the first time this season, or these kids are going to have a real hard time finding those Easter eggs. Now, if my children were a little older, maybe this would be cool, right? Because the grass is about, you know, up to our shins at this point. So maybe it'd be a real feat. But given that they are only 2 and 5, they probably need them a little more visible. So we need to cut some grass before the Easter Bunny arrives. But that's what we got going on. All the Easter things happening this weekend. We've got hunts. We've got hams. We've got deviled eggs. I'm going to make those because that's one of my favorites. And I feel like Easter is the time to do it. And so that's what's happening in the Lang household this weekend.
I guess I feel like I'm looking at the lawn right now and it hasn't grown yet, but I'm just too far north for any of this, I guess.
I'll tell you, there's a difference, I think, in the grass, right? Because we have two different types of grass out front. I don't remember the name. My husband got real into it. Zoysia, maybe. And then in the back is like something different. And the front grass is dead as a doornail. I mean, it is brown. But out in our backyard, it is lush. So maybe it's the type of grass you have, Joe. I don't know.
Possibly so. That's a good point. All right, so across my sky. Now, I did have one, and this was about New Jersey growing maple syrup. I did not expect that to happen in New Jersey. That was a surprise. New Jersey last year made 1,200 gallons of syrup last year. So take that, Vermont. But anyway, then this happened, and I said we have to talk about this. So if you're a lottery person, the Mega Millions was at $1.128 billion. The winner was in New Jersey, and that's fine. But it was at the grocery store that I used to go to. That's where the winning $1.2 billion grocery store ticket was. So nothing's happening across my sky because I still have the same amount of money I did yesterday. But darn, good for that ShopRite and good for whoever won that had a life-changing amount of money at the Jersey Shore. So, you know, they said never fall in love at the Jersey Shore. Shout out to the Jersey Shore show. But you can fall in love with $1.128 billion, I think, pretty easily. So that's what's happening across my sky, guys.
So you're saying is you're at work today because that wasn't you. You didn't disappear and find yourself a good lawyer.
That's correct. No, I don't even really have a lawyer, you know, for anything.
Well, once you have $1 billion, you can find a lawyer real fast.
That's true. Well, I'll put it on my plans. Win the billion, hire a lawyer. I'll ask you for some advice, Sean. Maybe you got a good lawyer for me that I can shot.
I certainly don't have $1 billion.
That is true. All right. So we have plenty of more episodes for you on Across the Sky. We have our special episode 2 with Ken Pomeroy, a.k.a. Ken Pom. We dropped that last Thursday, just in time for the Sweet 16 and March Madness. But coming up next Monday, we have our first hurricane season outlook from the fine folks at Colorado State University. We are speaking with them about what we're expecting for the upcoming season. And then on the 15th of April, we have David Dillahunt from Southwest Airlines because, well, for two reasons. One, we all know what it's like being a meteorologist at a commercial airline. But second, they actually have meteorologists that are flying on Southwest flights through the eclipse on April 8th. So we're going to hear from his perspective about what was going on there. And we're pretty much booked with episodes all the way until Memorial Day. So we have the content coming out for you on the Across the Sky podcast. If you want to submit a question, you can go to podcast@lee.net. That email again is podcast@lee.net. We will be back with you again next Monday. Wherever you get your podcast, make sure to download it and subscribe. And we appreciate it, as always, for tuning in to the Across the Sky podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.